Steve, you seem to have a sort of a way of finding places that are cold and wet. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we are. Anyway. I first came to Coomera 35 years ago on my honeymoon, so it shows what sort of a romantic kind of guy that I am. And along with my lack of romanticism is my lack of fashion sense. So I always have to have a job that I have a uniform, because I never know what to wear. And what I do wear, my wife generally sort of says, "You can't wear that, dear. That's not going to work." Steve asked me just briefly just to sort of give you a little bit of insight as to where, how I arrived at this particular point. So I was born in the UK and spent my first 21 years there. And I did it, and I was I went to church with my family. I thought nothing of going to church. Church is what you did on a Sunday morning. And of course, as we all know, back in those days, there was nothing else to do on a Sunday than what we did. I never questioned it. I never gave it a second thought. That's what I did. Until I got to about the age, probably about 17 or 18, and then I did question it, and I began to realise that there was lots of other things out there that I could do on a Sunday morning. Some of them not desperately wholesome, like getting over hangovers and the like. I'm sure I was a classic sort of 18-year-old. So yes, there was a period of time where church, for me, I questioned, I guess. Yeah, let's say that. I then subsequently came to Australia when I was 21, and I floated a bit. I was married at 22, and then my wife and I began to think about having children. And the lights, I think at that point, began to come on for me when I realised this incredibly solid foundation that I'd been given. And I wanted that very, very much for my own children. And I didn't really know what to do. And my parents came out from England, and my dad said, well, son, you know, where are you going to church? And I sort of shuffled and rather embarrassedly looked down at my feet and said, well, I don't know, really, I'm not going, you know. Anyway, we went to a particular church, and I had a bit of one of those moments that perhaps most of us have had at different times, where it suddenly had dawned on me that I felt incredibly at home. I had this sense that I knew what was going on, and yet all this had been going on without me. All these people had been gathering every Sunday, saying their prayers, worshipping God, and I hadn't been a part of it. And yet, I had, in a certain sort of way. It was, I very quickly became a member of that congregation. But my questioning, I then, rightly or wrongly, wanted to engage at a more intellectual level. It was speaking to my heart very much, but I wondered whether I needed more. I still don't really know whether what I was thinking. It was hard to know. So I went to college and I began to think a little bit more intellectually about this. You know, the creed, for example. What does that mean to say that? Where does that come from? So anyway, I engaged with that. I got very much immersed in that, and I began to... I was working as a postman at the time, another job in a uniform, so that was useful. And being a minister, or coming into ministry generally, was first thing to my mind, really. I was out delivering mail. But there was this enormous sense of something more all of the time, this sense of being drawn home, sense of snow. Very, very hard to describe, but it was so real and so persistent. I didn't know quite what to do. I'd done a little bit of study, and I'd enjoyed some biblical, some Bible study, and some historical study. And then the minister, the priest of our church, was appointed as a bishop. And we had a parish council meeting, and at the end of the meeting, what we did, we ganged up on him, basically, and we decided what we were going to do was put a motion to set aside all business. Because we were going to have a party. He didn't know about that at the time. So we passed, we did all the things that needed to be done, you know, passing the financial statements and all that, you know, the minutes of the previous meeting and all that stuff. And then somebody said, I want to pass a motion. He said, I want to set aside business, all the business. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I want to set aside business. He said, well, okay. Went to the council, we all unanimously approved it. Somebody then appeared with a tray, you know, and there was some champagne, some orange juice, and nibblings, whatever we were around the party. Anyway, I suddenly found myself on my own with him, which was rare. He was a busy man, you know, and you always have people wanting to speak to him. And suddenly there we were on our own. And he said to me, I've been meaning to talk to you. And I said, I could feel this sort of sense of foreboding welling up in me that he's going to make a demand upon my life, you know. And he said, I want to know what you're going to do with the rest of your life. And I, from that moment on, things began to fall into place for me. I then moved to Wangaratta. I came to Canberra to do my study. I was ordained. I worked as an assistant to various parishes. I ended up at Kilmore and Steve. I got my degree, and then I went into the army, and I had 7.5 years in the army. And then I was persuaded to leave the full-time army and come back into parish life, which I've done, and I'm now the rector of St. Philip's Oak High. I'm not a Damascus Road person. When it came to that divergence in the road, you know, Emmaus or Damascus, it was always going to be Emmaus. Just me. I'm walking alongside Jesus all the time, and sometimes I just fail to recognise him. And that's something that, it's me, it's just the way I am. I've never had a bright light moment. But there we are, we're all different, aren't we? I'm very grateful for the fact that that I have recognised him at those very important times. Such is life. Such is faith. So that's me, and I've ended up at St. Philip's now, and I'm on the staff at Duntree. So I thought what I wanted to talk to you about this morning was military chaplaincy, but not going to tell you war stories and all that sort of stuff. I want to talk to you about the difficulties of being a modern military chaplain in a secular environment. But what that means for us, because really and truly we're all in the same boat. Our mission and the mission of the military chaplain is not so very different. Not really. During my time in the regular army, I had three postings. I had two postings to South East Queensland, and I had a posting to the 1st Recruit Training Battalion at Wagga. So it's in Kapooka, just outside Wagga. Those of you who have been in the army might have heard of Wagga or heard of Kapooka. Up to 1,000 recruits are trained there at any one given time. It's a big place. It's a very busy place. And every Tuesday, two platoons of raw recruits arrive on the bus. And as you can imagine, we as chaplains would watch them arrive. And you could, well, Jeff, you were talking about job. You were talking about, you know, having your hair cut, getting into uniform and all that stuff. You can smell the fear and the anxiety in these young people. Some of them are not so young, I have to say. Before they arrived, I would look at the data. So we would be given a readout of those who are about to arrive. And as I say, two platoons. So there would be, say, about 120 young folk every Tuesday arriving. The data would give us things like age, marital status, gender, all that good stuff. And importantly, religion. They have a box to tick there as well. Let me just give you some statistics. This was when I was there, and I have no reason to suggest that there's a lot of difference today. This was April 2015. There are 115 young people in this intake. Regarding religion, 65 of them, of the 115, 65 ticked not applicable, none, or left the question blank. So of 115, 65 ticked or failed to tick. 18 ticked Catholic, 16 ticked Christian, 7 ticked Anglican, 3 ticked atheist, 2 Lutherans, 2 Orthodox, 1 Methodist, and 1 agnostic. That just gives you a sort of something of the raw material that we as chaplains are operating with. And that, folks, is for me, I think that's probably a good overview of the demographic of the world out there. we, not just as military chaplains, but we as Christians are engaging in a society that is not listening to us. And you really feel it when you are dealing with those young people. It's different for them, to some extent, because they're scared, they're homesick, they're lonely, they're hungry, they're tired, and somehow those give you opportunities that the majority of us wouldn't have. But, as I say, the demographic is what we are dealing with. As chaplains, we're not permitted to engage in any type of overt proselytising. You can't do it. And you will be censured. If you endeavour to do that, you will be censured. There's no question about that. So, the question, I guess, is how do we, as military chaplains, engage in this demographic? As an extension for that, what does that mean for everybody else, the rest of us in this mission field? This is the question that the chaplaincy department must face, and it's tough. In the past, the numbers of chaplains and the denominational mix has been established by the numbers of adherence to any particular religion. So, for example, if we look at those, if we were to look at that data there, there should be more Catholic chaplains than anything else, followed by 16 Christian chaplains, 7 Anglicans, etc. But, as you can see, the balance has become completely skewed because of these huge numbers of non-applicables, plus the fact that there aren't enough Catholic chaplains anyway, there aren't enough Catholics generally, not in ministry. So it's difficult. It's sort of starting to get quite rocky. How do we deal with that? What is the answer? I don't have an answer, strictly speaking, other than being faithful. And I think that's the only thing that we can do, is to keep persevering. Let me just give you some ideas about what I think about the way that this might work. Now, the motto of the chaplaincy department, and you see it on my beret badge there, is "In this sign conquer." That's the motto of the chaplaincy department of the army. It was adopted by the British Army in their establishment, when the chaplaincy department was established in the British Army, and we adopted it in 1913 when the Australian Army chaplaincy department was formed. And there's no doubt the Christian mission has been seen in the past in terms of a fairly military sort of an idea, hasn't it? Now, we've spawned the Salvation Army, for example. And in Anglicanism, we have the Church Army. We have hymns on the Christian soldiers and those sorts of things. It's been a very important part of our understanding of mission. We've seen it in quite regularly in military terms. But warfare has changed. Warfare has changed dramatically. But the First and the Second World Wars are no longer the wars of today. We fight very different wars today. And our understanding of being a soldier, too, has changed very much. Since the Second World War, really, and up until our present day, the idea of a soldier has changed from being a merely a combatant to being a mentor, a linguist, a peacekeeper. The army requires of soldiers cultural sensitivity, geopolitical and strategic awareness. We use the term the strategic corporal. The decisions that the corporal makes have strategic, implications. The corporal stuffs up culturally. Before that worked out, we had a major issue. Look what happened when inadvertently a Quran was burnt. Now, when I was in Afghanistan, a Quran was burnt. Also when I was in Afghanistan, an American soldier went on a rampage and slaughtered a number of people. You would have thought that that would have created more outrage than the Quran being burnt. It didn't. That second event barely caused a blip. The Quran being burnt created havoc across the whole area of operation. The strategic corporal, the fairly lowly guy whose error or whose actions has enormous impact. So we ask a lot of our soldiers, We also ask them to have an appreciation of the spiritual. Among the 10 soldierly qualities that we ask of our soldiers are compassion and respect. So, you can see that the idea of warfare is changing dramatically. And I think what we've endeavoured to do, what I've tried to do, is to understand those changes and understand the changes in the way that we understand the church's mission. War in the past has been about expansion. So if you're an infantry soldier, what do? You take ground and you hold ground in any time, in any weather, and in any place. It's a sort of the motto of the infantry soldier. Expansion. However, I think the church's mission of expansion has probably come to an end. You know, in the old days, you went out to far-flung Africa, didn't you, to expand the kingdom. I think we need to be different. We need to approach this differently. A modern soldier today is not about expansion, but is about encounter. And I think the same applies to us in our mission. Not necessarily about expansion, but about encounter. Now, I know that's subtle. It's not just about taking ground, it's about encountering the people in that ground. Now, the primary military strategic doctrine that we operate under today is called COIN, C-O-I-N. And the doctrine of and COIN stands for counterinsurgency. And that's the premier doctrine under which we operate in the army today. We are trying to counter insurgents. That's the difficulty with what we call asymmetric warfare. We're not fighting an army. So we're not just pointing guns at each other, you know, and we're all in uniform, and there's a set of rules and regulations that apply to that. We are now dealing with folk who are coming from civilian populations. They are largely armed civilians. They don't fight under any codes of honour. They're not interested in the Geneva Conventions or anything of that nature. So we are countering that insurgency, COIN doctrine. So we're trying not to gain ground, but to counter these folk, to counter what we might call a dominant narrative that these insurgents are trying to say. The insurgents have a narrative that they're trying to sow among the people of, let's say, Afghanistan, which is where I live. And we're trying to counter that by our actions. Not at the point of a gun, by the way that we manage ourselves and deal with ourselves in the way that we deal with the locals. We are not expanding, we are encountering. The principles of COIN doctrine, which is military principles, are host nation primacy. Now what we're doing, we're not going in there and saying, rightio folks, we're here, we're your saviours, it's all happening now. You know, we're saying, hey, what can we do to help you? What can we do? This is your nation. What do you want from your nation, and what can we help you? How can we help you do that? We need adaptation, so we need to adapt. Again, you can't go in and say, right now folks, we're here, it's my way or the highway. Again, it doesn't work, does it? It just doesn't work. There is also presence. Our presence in that country. How do we present ourselves? That full frontal sort of attack and assault doesn't work. We've got to present ourselves in new and different ways. So I think these apply very much and have application in the way that we deal with ourselves in our Christian mission. Not just the military. It's the way that we deal with what is, dare I say, a counterinsurgency out there. It's a narrative that's coming at us, isn't it? It comes on the television screens all the time. Buy this, do that, don't do that, look like this. You know, there's a constant... I mean, our kids have been bombarded with it, aren't they? It's our job almost to do the counterinsurgency piece, isn't it? To counter that dominant narrative that says your life will be great if you do this or you buy that. We know that's not true. We know it's not true. So how do we deal with this? How do we deal with it in the army? What's the application for us? Well, the first thing that I think, and one of the most important things, is when you arrive in these countries where there is insurgency, is that there is poverty. That's the first thing you notice when you land there. Incredibly deep, grinding poverty. You know, we might think Kuba's cold. Afghanistan in January, you know, is unbelievably cold. Deep snow, and people living in mud buildings. It's very, very biblical. Poverty and equality lie at the heart of those of that insurgency in Afghanistan, because these people, why wouldn't they? If an insurgent comes and says, hey, here's $15, you know, follow me. $15 would keep that bloke going for months on end. He could feed his family for months. Of course he's going to follow him, isn't he? When you're grindingly poor, you will follow. Plus faith. The poor folks, totally terrified. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda, they're really interested in caring for that bloke in any shape or form. So, breaking the cycle of poverty is the first thing that we are called to do. The church needs to have that, what the Catholics call the preferential option for the poor. Where do we deal with poverty? Now, I know that we don't have grinding poverty in Australia, but we have a poverty of spirit. It's a poverty of spirit. And I think we can see it. We see it in the issues, and I guess, gentlemen, you may have seen it in your families and amongst your friends, issues in mental health, and all these other things that we're endeavouring to do. There is a poverty of spirit. We need to break that cycle. Because when there is a poverty of spirit, people will follow things. They will look for answers. We need to find those answers. Second issue of military coin counterinsurgency doctrine also applies to us. That is dialogue. Principles of mission and dealing with an enemy, if you like, is dialogue. We talk. And this is an area where we as chaplains have an important role to play in the work in Afghanistan. What we used to call engagement teams. Now these engagement teams will go out into those communities to talk to people, to sit down and to engage at their level. So for me, for example, my job was to engage with the mullahs and the imams in those villages, and the mullahs and imams looking after the Afghan military. So yes, I'd go in, I'd take my boots off, there were no seats, we all sit on the ground, and we would sit and we would talk. And we would discuss. I'd have to have an interpreter with me. I don't speak Farsi or Pashtun, you know, the regular languages of that place. I had to have an interpreter. Fortunately, I had a very good interpreter, and he understood that I was trying to talk about theological concepts and ideas. It wasn't just conversational stuff, you know. And of course, the world wanted to challenge me about my beliefs about Jesus. That's the thing they want to talk about. They want to talk about Jesus. What do you think about Jesus? They say to me. I say, well, I know what he was on about. Because I know you guys have spoken to Islam or Islamic folk or know anything about modern Islam, you would know. Hey, Jesus is up here for them. He's just not quite up there. he's an incredibly important character. He ain't up there. So that was, but it was important. It was important that we dialogue. So the female engagement teams will go out to talk to the women and sit and talk to the women and find out their concerns for the health of their children and little ones. So dialogue. We must keep our dialogue. And that includes between us as Christians. It's great to be in an ecumenical, Steve said earlier on, you know, this is his natural habitat. You know, he's quite at home in an ecumenical setting. And I am too these days, increasingly. You work in an army chaplaincy, you've got to work with the Prezies, your Catholics, your Baptists, your Salvation Army guys, you know, girls, you name it. You've got to work alongside them. Dialogue. We must keep on talking to those folk out there. They might not be listening. We've got to make sure that we are keep talking, and we need to keep listening to them as well. So we also need, as I said to you before, this business of creating a narrative. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda, they're busy with their narrative. We need to be busy with ours as well. And we would do that by, we used to do it with the engineers, building schools, building hospitals. That was our narrative. There was the army used an expression called being the narrative. You live that narrative. So you would be respectful in dealing with the way that they feel. I'd learn some Islamic phrases, not overtly religious ones, but you know, greetings and those sorts of things. We can't change things by violence. It doesn't work. I think Vietnam proved that. But we're still making those same mistakes. Narrative becomes authentic when it's witnessed, when you witness it, you do it. What did St. Francis say? Preach the gospel, use words if you must. You know, we endeavour to live that out. That was what we were called to do, that's what we are called to do. Authentic witness, which is the way that we. It's proclamation in bricks and mortar of our lives. Peacekeeping is another intrinsic part of counterinsurgency. How do we keep a peace? Now peace, in the Hebrew scriptures, peace is associated with that Hebrew concept of shalom. It's crucial to the Jewish people. Shalom is a crucial part of their understanding of their faith. But it's much more than peace. There's a bloke called von Rahn, who was a great German theologian back in the day, and he said, we constrict the term shalom if we equate it with just peace. If we just want to talk about peace, then there's much more to shalom. It's intrinsically tied up with wholeness and wells and justice. So we need to be peacekeepers, but we need to be more than that. We need to be people who bring about shalom, that great Jewish idea of justice and completeness, wholeness. Again, you try and bring justice by the point of a gun, it's not going to work. It doesn't happen. Unfortunately, we have to use it sometimes. This was the dreadful thing for me, and the dreadful moral dilemma for me, was that I was involved in a group of blokes and girls who ultimately sometimes had to try and achieve their aims at the point of a gun. And that was difficult. And I had to carry a gun when I was outside the wire, which was an enormously difficult thing for me to do. And I was challenged by a Muslim leader who said to me, it's a sad day when a man of God has to carry a gun. And I said, yes it is. It was just that day, and I can't express to you enough how it saddens me, but I have no choice. No gun. I don't come out here. I'm not allowed out here. What they call the green on blue attacks were all happening about that time, so we were not aware. You know, it wasn't obviously the enemy, it could have been anybody, it could have been the guy I was talking to. But, I mean, they're all armed, everybody's armed. It's like the Wild West. I mean, heaven knows what would have happened if I had to draw that pistol. I'm a rocket shot as well, but you know, I can't even begin to imagine what I would have, what I would do. But there it was, on my head. It's a sign, is it not, of our fallen nature, the fact that ultimately we do recourse to violence. answer is. I don't have an answer. So, the next part of our mission, if you like, which is what we try and impress upon the guys, is the fact that they need to engage in, and I use the term prayer and worship, I would use different words for them, but I want you to start being thoughtful. We need you to start thinking, reflectiveness, mindfulness. Once I'm looking to think about those terms, I can start to think about prayer and worship. I can guide them down that path. Remember what I say, we need to be careful about the language we use. It's difficult. So, when we consider the fact that the padre is wearing a gun, it's an acknowledgement of sinfulness. It's an acknowledgement of our faults, and it means that we commit ourselves to repentance, to change. But it's an ongoing process, it never ends. So there's this idea that our mission, of course, is part of our prayer, our practice in church, however we might conduct ourselves, whether we come from a liturgical background that's, you know, ritualistic, or whether we're much more of an open, free type of worship man. I read this from a bloke called Stanley Howells. He's an American religious theologian and ethicist. And he says, the Christian alternative to war is worship. Because war is about sacrifice, and sacrifice for us is about worship, isn't it? We pass the ideas of sacrifice, aren't we? As Christians, we've left that behind. Our sacrifices are sacrifices of prayer and praise. In Anglicanism we say, you know, we offer here ourselves and bodies to be a holy, reasonable and lively sacrifice unto thee. That's the old language. Our souls and bodies, our prayer and praise is our sacrifice. So Stanley Halbos says that the alternative to war is worship. The church doesn't have a plan or a policy to end war. But really, we say we have an alternative to our war-weary world, and it's worship. Prayer and worship are the opposite of war. But that too reminds us, of course, that the church too is a sign of our fallen humanity. If we were perfect, we wouldn't need church, would we? You know, we wouldn't need prayer and worship, we'd be perfect. It's a sign of we are still striving. And that's why we still have to have an army, in my view. I'd love to be a pacifist. I'd love to shit this. I didn't want to go to Afghanistan particularly. I mean, I'm very grateful for that opportunity because it taught me a lot about myself and about other people. But I'd much rather if I didn't. Much rather if those problems weren't there. But they are. And they continue to be there. But I mean, it's not Afghanistan, it's Syria. If it's not Syria, it's somewhere else. If it's not somewhere else, it's... You know, they keep popping up, don't they? And we fool ourselves, I think, if we think suddenly that we're going to wake up one day to some sort of utopian heaven in this world. So, gentlemen, can I say that it's... Whilst people despair a little because of our demographic and numbers of young folk, we do have a plan. It's probably not the plan that perhaps we might have in the old days, and when we talk about mission. Perhaps some of you would like to see us much more out there in people's faces talking about Jesus. I'm sure that you acknowledge that that's quite tricky on a number of levels. One, because the army don't want us to do it, which is tricky, but we do find ways around that carefully. We need to think about breaking cycles of poverty. That's not just material, but spiritual. How do we break that? How do we engage? How do we find times for dialogue? Or is it easy sometimes just to hold our tongues? We do need to keep talking. We need to create a dominant narrative. In the army, that's overcoming the narrative of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, who tell their people that we are on crusade. They tell them that we're just lackeys of America who have come to destroy their culture and their nation. We need to have, in the army, we had to create a narrative that dominated that narrative. And we need to do the same in our own way, we need to counteract the dominant narrative that's out there in our community that says, buy this, buy that, do this, do that, and life will be good. We need to be people who live shalom, people who live seeking wholeness and justice. We need to be people of prayer, and we need to be people of worship, which is the antidote, if you like, to warfare. The problems arise for us as Christians quite often in dealing with a multi-faith and multicultural world where we want to talk about the uniqueness of Christ. But that's when the rubber hits the road. The rubber hits the road when I found it when I was dealing with those Muslim characters, those imams, who were, they were lovely guys, you know. But the uniqueness of Christ, they will not come at. But what we need to do and have an appreciation is that the paradise that they talk about, that the Islamic folk talk about, the nirvana, if you like, of our Buddhist brethren, the moksha of the Hindu people, are very different to the Christian notions of salvation. They are very different. There is an axiom that says no salvation outside the church. I think we're frightened of that. I think we're frightened of that because it smacks rather of us being just a little bit good, doesn't it? But if we by salvation, we mean the Christian understanding of salvation, which is a share in the liberation and the healing associated with the rule of God that Jesus proclaimed, then it is true. That is our salvation. And there is no salvation outside the church. I hope you can get what I'm my drift there, what I'm trying to say. But we can be bold about that. We can be bold without denigrating our cousins, Islamic cousins, our more distant relatives who might be Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. We can say, yes, for us there is no salvation outside the church because our salvation is a share in the kingdom of God, which was proclaimed by Jesus. So, our mission, peace, shalom, justice, dialogue, cultural awareness, yes, witness, proclamation, reconciliation, liberation, healing, prayer and worship. These are all issues that go with military counterinsurgency doctrine. Can I suggest you, gentlemen, that it be our mission as well?